Amen. All right. Before we get going, I want to somewhat re-explain my pedagogical style, because some of you have expressed concerns as to why I do what I do. And I'll explain to you what I'm thinking. That way, you can disagree with me, but at least you know I have a reason. I am intentionally spending time at the beginning of each class to restate what we've already said, because I believe in the Jewish proverb that repetition is the mother of all knowledge and wisdom. I believe it's true. I want you saying this stuff in your sleep. I don't want you guys to be sitting there going, I kind of get it. And you know what? If you get it on the first time, awesome. That means whenever you hear it the second or the third time, that then it'll be much more easy for you to explain it to someone else later. Does that make sense? So I apologize if the first 10 minutes frustrate you, but I won't apologize for doing it. And I probably won't stop, because it's going to set us up for success for the last 13 weeks of the class. You will not have repetition during the presentation times. What we're doing during the presentation times is reflecting on what we've done the first month. Going, okay, so how does honor shame impact the way in which we read this passage in 1 Thessalonians 5? And I don't want to have to re-explain what honor shame is then. I want you guys to have it down. Or how does empire studies impact Philippians, like we were talking about earlier? I don't want to have to re-explain what empire studies is and how the framework is. We're going over it now. And I'm going over it as thorough as I can so that no one will have an excuse later. Does that make sense? For some of you, this may be old hat. Great. For a lot of you, it's not. And I'm really more focused about the people that it's not than I am those that have already know it. It's a pedagogical principle that I'm most concerned about the student that needs the most help. It's one of the reasons why I think that the inner three weren't really the ones that were the most standouts in the disciples. I think they were the ones that are the most dense. And that's why Jesus kept them around him more. That's my own personal opinion. And one of those was John, my favorite apostle. But it makes sense. The people that a lot of times spend the most time with me are the ones that need the most help. And I'm cool with that. So, in case you're wondering, why does he keep repeating? That's why. Because I want to set us up for success. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay. We're doing empire studies. And I'm pretty excited, because what we're going to do is we're going to finish up this discussion on hidden transcripts. I'm going to give you another example, in addition to Romans 13, of how this rubber meets the road. Then I'm going to give some caveats of critiquing somewhat empire studies, some of the places I think it's overstepping its boundaries, and some nuances that I'd like to add to the equation. Okay? Right now, hidden transcript is the work of which person? James C. Scott, exactly. From the Weapons of the Week and the... Hello, my wife. Sorry about that. We're not doing that yet. James C. Scott, Weapons of the Week, Dominations of the Art of Resistance. We've talked about the public transcript, which is...
the interaction of the sovereign and the subject.
Yes, in the public space, in this arena where everyone intersects their lifestyles. But then you have two types of hidden transcripts, one of them being...
Sovereign.
The sovereign hidden transcript. And what's the purpose of the sovereign hidden transcript, Si?
To keep their power.
To keep their power, exactly. Because if they show disunity out in public, in the public transcript, it will be one of the things that deteriorates their hegemony. If they show that what they are trying to conceal, and that is this austerior dominance and power, and if that comes out in the public transcript, it could cause an overthrow. Then you have the hidden transcript of the subjects. What is the subject? What do they do? What's their intention? Or how do we define that? Maybe that should be a better way of saying it. Because intentionality is hard to define.
Subvert the authority.
Yeah, in some sense, to regain some of their own dignity and power that has been ripped away from them in the public transcript. So they get over here, and there are some subversive elements to it, because that's the way in which they survive as a community. One of the things we didn't talk about, but I'll mention right now, is there are actually several elements that have to exist in order for a hidden transcript of the subjects to even come to manifestation. One of the things has to be, there has to be a social space that is separate from the public transcript. And if there is not a social space, then that hidden transcript for the subjects cannot develop. And that would make sense why. Because if they have no place of their own, then they can't even discuss what it is that they are objecting to. Right? That there wouldn't be a common hidden transcript. This can also be done, though, in a common language. A social space doesn't have to be a location. My argument in Revelation is that the social space of Revelation is the Old Testament. Therefore, he can speak it about illusions crazy, and it would, in some sense, keep it a bit veiled from the Roman Empire until you at least get to chapter 17, and then they kind of show all their cards. But you have to have a social space, and you really, a lot of times, also have a leader that is... I don't know if I agree with this totally, but James C. Scott calls it infrapolitics. That you have a social leader that's enforcing the subject's hidden transcripts on all the other subjects. I don't know if that's necessary, but I can see it as a valuable insight. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but whatever. Now the question becomes, how does the hidden transcript of the subject come into the public transcript? We talked about, we're in the middle of talking about the explicit revelation of the hidden transcript in the public. And what was the first thing we talked about? One of the ways they do it explicitly in public.
It comes out at a safe distance.
They do it in some way that it shrouds them with anonymity so that they are able to express their frustration or their disagreement with what is being enforced in the public transcript. But they also don't feel the ramifications of it all at the same time. Remember the example I gave you of me walking down Egypt the summer after 9/11 and I had rocks being thrown at me? That's the idea. I couldn't tell where they were coming from. Bottom line was, at a safe distance, they were able to express their frustration. Here is the second one. Now, this is the stuff we haven't talked about yet. The second explicit revelation is open rebellion. This is what we oftentimes are the only things we look for in historical documents for any sort of resistance. Open rebellion. Whenever there is a peasant uprising or whenever the empire has to suppress it. And that's whenever we say, see? Oh yeah, now they're upset. As if before they weren't. And all of a sudden now they're like, yeah, let's pick up arms. Why? Because what he just did in this moment made me mad. No. There's always something that precedes an open rebellion. And a lot of times that's where the hidden transcript is resting. That's one of the things. We were talking about this. I was talking about it with Michael at the end of class yesterday. Is to suggest that just because we see the open persecution of Christians in the 60s, that's the first time that it really got bad, is to simply misunderstand hidden transcripts. It's not just the displeasure of the subjects that comes out in rebellions, but persecutions, that's also the time period in which you see the overt displeasure of the sovereigns against the subjects. Nevertheless, it doesn't mean there weren't tensions beforehand. It isn't all of a sudden like Nero's going, yeah, now I'm mad at Christians. There is a story behind it. What a lot of times what comes out in the annals whenever you see the rebellions or the open persecutions, a lot of times what's coming out is the boiling tensions that have been there all the whole time. It's just now they're being manifested in a violent way. Does that make sense? Open rebellions is an explicit way of them showing their displeasure or their hidden transcript in the public transcript, but that's very rare. That is never the goal of hidden transcripts. Because open rebellion, a lot of times, they don't have the power to rebel anyway. We'll talk about that more in just a bit. Second major category, obviously, if we have the explicit revelation, we also have the implicit revelation. And this is what we're primarily focusing on inside of our texts. The implicit revelation of the hidden transcripts. Just go ahead and define that for me. It should be self-evident, but I want to make sure we're all following. What is it? Go ahead.
It's a subversion. It's at a safe distance, but in a different sort of way.
Yeah. Yeah, it's something that may or may not come out in the public transcript. But if it does, it's going to be done in such a veiled way that it does keep them a safe distance, but it's more implicit than even throwing a rock. It's something along the... Well, a lot of times James C. Scott looks at rumors, or gossip, or folk tales, or songs, or gestures, or jokes, or even theater, as means of having the hidden transcript implicitly being revealed, but without all plausible deniability. I think James C. Scott overstates this a bit, but I'll go ahead and say that he even suggests that every single time that there is an interaction ever between a subject and a sovereign in the public transcript, that there's always a hidden transcript from the subject that you can read between the lines. I think that's overstated. And the reason why is because I truly do believe some of the subjects are complicit. I think that they, some of them really are okay with being dominated in the way they're dominated. Because some of them, for multiple reasons, some of them just don't even see a reason of even being upset about it because there's absolutely nothing they can do, so why worry about it? Others of them may like what's being offered to them by the dominated. To suggest that there's a uniform reaction of the subjects to the sovereigns is to really, I think, to reduce sociological realities down to a point of anomaly, if not incoherence. Does that make sense? Nevertheless, I do agree with what he says here. Scott says, what may look from above like the extraction of a required performance can easily look from below like the artful manipulation of deference and flattery to achieve its own ends. So it may look from above like, oh yeah, they're doing exactly what I told them to do in the public transcript. From below, it elicits laughter because it's exactly the opposite. It's undercutting everything that the public transcript is about. So what's the purpose? We've talked about this some. To regain dignity. To regain power. In some sense, they gain an identity that the sovereigns have stripped away from them by developing and by holding on to a hidden transcript. It's an identifying agent, a community-forming agent, which may be significant for the New Testament. This quote really sums up everything we've been talking about. This is a fantastic quote. I'll even tell you the reference because I like it so much. It comes from Scott's book, Domination, the Arts of Resistance, page 113, in case you care. He says this, we know relatively little about a villager of Malaysia, if we know only that he is poor and landless. A lot of times that's whenever our historical inquiries stop. They're poor, they're landless. He says, if that's all we know relatively little. He says, we know far more about the cultural meaning of his poverty once we know that he is particularly in despair because he cannot afford to feed guests on the Feast of Ramadan, that wealthy people pass him on the village path without uttering a greeting, that he cannot bury his parents properly, that his daughter will marry late, if at all, because he lacks a dowry, that his sons will leave the household early since he has no property to hold them, and that he must humble himself, often to no avail, to beg for work and rice from wealthier neighbors. To know the cultural meaning of his poverty in this way is to learn the shape of his indignity, and hence to gauge the content of his anger. Dignity is at once a very private and a very public attribute. Do you hear that? This honestly, even studying this has made me even more impassioned for my heart for the poor. Oh, it ticks me off. We're walking in Scotland and we had some people there that were with us. And there was this lady that my family had developed a relationship with because every single day on the church that we went to, she would sit on the steps and she'd have out her cup and she would just sit there. She was a mess. She stunk. And every day, my wife made a point of this. If I was walking by on the way to a new college to my little makeshift office there, and I saw her, I'd make sure I give her some money. And every single day, my wife would go by with the kids. She would stop, and my daughter Paige would put something in her cup. And her name was Rebecca, and Rebecca would grab my daughter's hand and would kiss it every day, multiple times. To the point where we knew her name, but she couldn't speak a lick of English. It took us probably 10 interactions to finally get her to understand what we were asking her, and we were asking her for her name. Eventually, though, we built this relationship with her, and at the very end, even though we couldn't speak English, we got down with her when we were getting ready to leave, and we asked her if we could take a picture with her so that we could remember and pray for her. And my wife got down and got right in her face, and she said, I know you can't understand what I'm saying, but I want you to know that we love you and that Jesus loves you and that even though you're poor here, that in Him you can be rich. And what was amazing to me was Rebecca just started weeping. She didn't even know really what we were saying. Maybe the Holy Spirit did something and He was able to communicate the name of Jesus to her without overarching the barrier language. But what really ticked me off was some people that had been there with us for a portion of the time, whenever we walked past Rebecca, they made the comment, what a lazy bum. Why doesn't she clean herself up and go get a job? And I sat there and I thought, man, you don't even know her story. You're acting like that her sitting on this stump is actually easier to make a living than maybe a receptionist sitting on their stump all day long. But because they have a job application, they have more dignity than her. She's not even worth most people's time or even glances. Do you know what it is like to sit down and have to rely on the people's sneers just to make it to get a meal? Do you understand the dignity that is raped away from someone when that's their job? Whenever we sociologically murder them by never even paying attention that they exist. And you're going to say you understand their situation? That's simply to not understand the subjects of a dominant society. You just don't get it. If you understand the story of the Malay villagers, you understand they're not just poor and landless. That it affects every fabric of their existence. That even in their own hometown, they are ghosts to some of the people that are running it. And the only place they can find solace and dignity is in a hidden transcript with other people that are ignored as well. You want to know why there's homeless communities? Because they've got to find identity just to make it. Because no one else in society wants to give it to them. It changes the way you look at things if you start understanding there's bigger implications economically whenever people are oppressed inside of a society because it affects every facet of their life. If one of the key requirements of your religion, like it is in Islam, is to do the Hajj or is to do, you know, Ramadan feast and things of that nature, and you can't afford to do it, even religiously it affects you. You see how this makes sense? All right. What I love about Scott's study is it challenges historians and theologians at the same time to say, what you see in the historical documents may not be the whole story. Open your eyes. Let's play with this. Why would it be difficult for us to hear or to see the hidden transcript throughout our historical documents and settings? Why would it be difficult?
A lot of times historical documents are part of the public transcript because they are roaming.
Good insight. Did you hear that? A lot of times the historical documents are supporting, perpetuating, and propaganda of the public transcript. Who writes the histories? The winners of the wars. Right? Whoever wins the war has the right to write the history. A lot of times we don't get the hidden transcripts because they're not the ones that get to control what gets put out into the public transcript. That's one of the reasons why... can you somebody shut that door for me? This may... I will... No, I don't need to tell you that. Okay, I believe, because particularly of a book from a guy by the name of Elon Pape called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, that the reason why Ahmadinejad refuses to acknowledge the Holocaust of the Jews is because he believes that the Holocaust of the Palestinians is not being acknowledged by anybody else in the world either. I don't believe he's a bad historian. I believe he is putting a hidden transcript into the public transcript by saying something that seems very strange. How could anybody deny that Jews were killed in the Holocaust? And he looks right back at you and say, how can you deny that in 1948, over 800,000 Palestinians were displaced from their homes and Israel planted their grounds there? No one seems to talk about that at all. We have over 1.5 million Palestinians that used to be on this land and now they're not. And nobody acts like it's a big deal. And he says, does no one see a problem with that Holocaust? How is it that we can justify the Holocaust of the Jews by allowing them to have a Holocaust on the Palestinians? One of the things that Elon Pape, who happens to be a Jewish historian, by the way, writes in his book, is that whenever the Jews at night came in and were raiding the villages in Palestine to take over the land that they wanted, by the way, they ignored the UN sanctions of how big their land was supposed to be anyway. One of the ways they do it is they would be burning down a home, and then if people would come back to look for their stuff in the rubble, they would also plant mines inside of it so it would destroy people and that everybody would get the message. We own this land. You don't. I don't care if you've been here for 1600 years. You don't have it anymore. It's ours. And Ahmadinejad says something stupid historically because I think he's trying to put in the public transcript his hidden transcript. You ignore their Holocaust, I'll ignore yours. It's a little more complicated. What you see on the surface may not actually be what's happening. There may be something bigger that's occurring. And the people that win the wars write the histories. Therefore, you're not going to see a lot of hidden transcripts. Why? Because the subjects aren't the ones writing what happened. They don't have that opportunity. What other reasons? And you can totally disagree with me on that reconstruction, by the way, but that's what my historical study has led me to. Yes?
We were just talking a minute ago about people in their own town being ignored as ghosts, and even if it's not exactly high-class people writing the histories, if it's just people observing, the people who are still being ignored, you're not going to hear anything.
Absolutely. Well, and there's even some implications to what you're saying there. If you are a sovereign, you're not going to be writing about all the people rebelling against you. It actually hurts your public image. You want to act like that under your reign, there was tranquility. The Pax Romana, absolute peace, Augustus says, while there's all these wars still going on in Rome. Because if you start talking about the people that are upset with you, it shows that you're really not a good leader because they're choosing not to follow you. So part of the reason, number one, is the people that are writing the histories. Number two, because if they wrote the true history, it would make them look bad. So why would we do that? I'll give you a third reason. A lot of times the subjects don't want to be heard. They're trying to save themselves in the moment. They're not worried about what is written down in the annals of history for the future. They don't want to be heard. They are trying to develop their identity. Is okay for their hidden transcript to only emerge subversively and at times. So therefore, if it's not on a billboard, they're cool with that. Because their very survival depends on it. As a result of these barriers, you have to understand that hidden transcripts are not easy to get to, but it doesn't mean they don't exist. Is that, you guys following me here? Okay. Let me give you a visual of what James C. Scott was developing. That way, if you're a visual learner like some people are, you can kind of see. This is what he's developing. This is the public transcript. Notice it is porous. Notice it is dotted line because different things can come in and out, and yet there is some definition. Notice where the dominant hidden transcript is. The goal is to keep it as far away from the public transcript as you can with no intention of bringing your hidden transcript into the public transcript. The subject hidden transcript, though, they know the faintness of their arrow. It actually helps them develop dignity if their hidden transcript sometimes surfaces. However, they're not going to make it as explicit as people maybe want it to be. This is what he's noticing. Does this all make sense? Yes? Okay. Can I go to the next slide, or are you guys wanting to write that down more? Yeah, go ahead. Oh, Joe, I said yes, and then, okay. Where are we at? There we go. And the definition enactment of the sovereign narrative with occasional emergence of subject hidden transcripts, I'm going to explain that more in the next slides. Yes?
This is just us putting language to how society was organized, right? Like, back then, they wouldn't have said,
well, this is our hidden transcript,
correct?
Mm-mm. We don't even say it today, and yet we do it all the time. Don't we? I mean, sometimes even with people you're talking to, sometimes this is just reality. If we're just pulling back the veil, sometimes even the way in which you guys will talk to professors that you don't really like, you'll say things to them intentionally, making a little bit of a jab at them, but not enough to where it'll actually get you in trouble. If you don't like them, I get it. I even know in the dorms that, you know what, there's a lot of people that my name is being smeared. I understand that. Why? Because I've also lived in the real world and in the church, and it happens there too. But you don't sit there and say, I'm about to announce my hidden transcript of Shane Wood. You don't do that. But you enact it. What this is doing is it's putting, like you said, it's putting language to what can be sociologically observed. And in putting language to it, it can actually understand how the way in which it functions, and then hopefully that'll help us with the historical inquiry when we're looking at documents. Because one of the things we'll talk about in a minute, what is unique about the Christian Bible is that this is a whole group of documents of hidden transcripts. This is the conversation that is happening behind the scenes that the empire is not being invited into. The epistle of Paul to the Corinthians is, in a sense, now don't get me wrong, not all hidden transcripts equal subversiveness, but it is a conversation that he is not wanting to get out into the public transcript necessarily. You see what I mean? We have a very unique opportunity with the New Testament to get to see what the subjects of an empire are talking about. And you don't get to see that very often. Which is why I think this is so huge for New Testament studies. Everybody got that now? This is what I want to add to the picture. I think that James C. Scott did a good job, but I think that we need to add another element to his depiction of what is occurring so that we can become more clear of what is happening. It is a public transcript and a hidden transcript and a hidden transcript, but there are things that are informing the hidden transcripts in the way they emerge into the public transcript, and I call them sovereign narratives and subject narratives. A narrative basically is how the world should be. The narrative of the sovereign, therefore, is the way in which the sovereign envisions how the world should be. And notice, the sovereign narrative goes directly into the public transcript, and the public transcript reinforces it. They have a symbiotic relationship. Because the sovereign narrative, how the world should be, the story of the sovereigns, that is what it defines the public transcript, and then what happens in the public transcript reinforces the sovereign narrative. Does that make sense how those two relate? Notice the subject narrative, the narrative of the dominated, how the world should be from their perspective, isn't what gets into the public transcript. It is what fuels and defines their hidden transcript. And the hidden transcript is what eventually makes its way into the public transcript. We're actually going to zoom in on this in the next slide, and I'm going to define this further down at the bottom. But you see how this makes sense. You've got to have a story that is informing or interacting or enforcing what it is that you're trying to perpetuate in the public transcript or in your hidden transcript. And that story is, from your perspective, how the world should be. And so a Roman would say, our story is that we are the dominant people of the world, that the gods have put us into power, that I myself am a son of God. As a result of that, this is how you act in the public transcript. This story informs, enforces what it is you're supposed to be doing here. And then down here you have the subjects going, actually our story says the exact opposite. And it's this story that's going to be developing our subversion, our hidden transcript, that then we will in some sense get into, hey Brian Hensley's Mac, that will in some sense get into the public transcript. Are you following me? So there's an ideology that fuels the hidden transcripts or the public transcript. Yes? Absolutely. And let's even take it to Babylon. Babylon's story, whenever they take over the Jews and they destroy the temple and they take all their artifacts into their pagan temples, is this. Our gods are stronger than yours, otherwise you would have won. We are the ones in control and you're subject to us. But how do the Jews tell their story in their hidden transcript? Actually, you are just a puppet of my God that's punishing us for the sins that we have done. You have two warring narratives that then come into the public transcript if you're the sovereign narrative, but it is a part of the hidden transcript if you're the subject. But it's the ideology that fuels or that informs the way in which they're going to react to what is occurring in the public transcript. Does that make sense? You see how these stories converge and they in a sense develop conflict. Okay, can I move to the next slide? Is everybody good with that? Because what I want to do now is zoom in on this section down here. This section down here, we're going to look at this a little more closely. Notice, now let me define this so that you can see what we got here. It's the same terms we've got. Subject narrative, or sovereign narrative. That was at the very top of the last screen, remember? and the symbiotic relationship between the public transcript. So that's nothing new. The question I have, though, is how does the hidden transcript both develop and be articulated in light of its subject narrative? This is the ideology that is going to be causing the existence of a hidden transcript itself. But this ideology isn't what develops the hidden transcript. You have two primary sources. The first primary source is the subject traditions. It is the common beliefs and myths and lore of the indigenous subjects. It is, for example, this would be the Old Testament for the Christians. And that subject tradition is going to be informing and adding key elements into their hidden transcript. But that's not the only source of the development of their hidden transcript. The other source is what I'm calling points of conversation. Points of conversation is this. There is so much that is flooding the public transcript that's coming from the sovereigns. So much. So much imagery, so many messages, so much of their narrative that they're flooding the public transcript. And what you will find is there are certain points of that public transcript that the subjects latch onto to talk about. They will say, you know what, this particular point is what I'm going to address. Like we talked about Romans 13. You're claiming to be the one that's in charge, a subject to no gods, especially not ours. And they say, we're going to latch on to that moment and we're going to talk about it down here. It's a point of conversation. They'll grab a particular image, like the Roman triumphal procession that we talked about in Colossians 2. And that image that's in the public transcript becomes a point of conversation for the subjects in the hidden transcript. And it starts to develop, these come in to develop what we find in the hidden transcript when we're reading their documents, or overhearing their conversations, or listening to their songs, or studying their jokes, or looking at their gestures. You see how this makes sense? These gestures, or these jokes, or these references don't come out of nowhere. They're being informed by two different particular tributaries. Subject traditions, something that they have in common together, their common stories, and then the points of conversation with the empire. Does that make sense?
How do we see their gestures?
Sometimes it's not just, for example, the Ethiopian proverb. The gesture of, and it's articulated in the text. That's one of the difficulties. If I'm looking back at the ancient text, I don't get to watch them. Although if I did, I'd probably be a lot more informed about what's happening. But man, you can see it. For example, the president gave a speech last night. What is one of the ways that whenever the GOP, the Republicans, are not going to be supporting their Democratic president, what do? When everybody else is clapping, they refuse. That gesture is saying something, isn't it? I think so. That's the whole point of the majority leader in the back and the vice president in the back and the vice president standing up while the majority leader is just sitting there rolling his eyes. That gesture says a lot. So we can see those, and we can see the hidden transcripts intentionally a lot of the times in those contexts coming out in the public transcript. But remember what happened not too long ago whenever somebody in Congress stood up and yelled something at the president. What happened to that person? He was chastised. Even though a lot of people agreed with them, they said, you are out of line. Why? Disagreement in the public transcript is okay, but you still have to follow some of the rules. You see what happens? Because being disrespectful like that makes our unity of our political government look too weak. And if it's that weak, then we could be vulnerable all across the world. So there are certain rules that they will filter in some of their hidden transcripts in, but if they do it over the line, then that person, it actually is counterproductive. Yeah?
I have two questions.
Absolutely.
The first is, would you call it subject narrative a worldview?
Yes. The reason why I've chosen the word subject narrative is because I'm trying to emphasize the story aspect that this is emerging out of. And a worldview has something to do with that, but it's not just the way in which they view the world, but it's bigger than that. It's the way they view the world because of the story they are a part of. Does that make sense?
And then, so I see the two arrows going back and forth from the transcript to subject narrative. Does that mean that the subject traditions and the points of conversation also affect subject narrative?
No.
Okay.
This is the symbiotic relationship. The ideology, the story they're a part of, is what is in what is both articulated in and then reinforced by the hidden transcript. But the actual language in which they are talking with the hidden transcript is where the subject traditions and the points of conversation come in. Does that make sense? This is the sources through which the articulation occurs in the hidden transcript. But what is being articulated is this. Therefore, the articulation of them comes in from this place. But those are not affecting this. Those are articulating this. Yeah?
How would I teach this in a church?
We're getting there. What is the point? Let's go back to the Empire Studies. What was the point of me taking 3 to 4 days to talk about this? To build a framework from which then we can interact. So, let me give you an example. This is how we can interact with Empire Studies in a way that actually brings the text to something meaningful, or coherence. Oh, we got plenty of time. Turn with Revelation chapter 20. This is actually what I'm doing my PhD on. This is what I presented at the British New Testament Conference, this idea. And it comes from this framework, from this Empire Studies. Revelation 20, 1 through 3. Actually, Revelation 20, 7 through 10 is one of the most confusing and oddly treated texts, I think, in the entire Bible. Revelation 20, 7 through 10 is the release of Satan. Whew, very strange. Matter of fact, what you have is you have a couple different ways people try to deal with this. Number one, they try to find the Old Testament allusions, which is a pretty important thing to do in Revelation. Here's the problem. There is no Old Testament allusion to Satan being released from an imprisonment in which he is bound. So it doesn't help us much. It'll give us some of the, you know, kind of the filler and the color, like the Gog and Magog. Okay, we know it's the last battle, but why is he released? That doesn't answer my question. Why is Satan released? Sometimes they'll try to answer the question by using theology, and this is where it gets crazy. You'll have the premillennials. They'll come along, they'll say, Satan's released at the end of the millennium. And as a result, there's 1,000 years of complete utopia where Jesus reigned on the earth. But at the very end, Satan's going to deceive somebody and they're going to cause a war. So if you read the 13th book of the Left Behind series, inside of the 1,000-year reign, the millennium, where there's all this utopia, there are brothels and pornography and there's kidnappings and murders, and you're going, not much of a utopia. But why do they have to put those weird details in there? Because there has to be someone for Satan to deceive when he is released. And if we have 1,000 years when there's complete utopia, they have a major theological problem of, then who is Satan? Who is there for Satan to release or to deceive? You see the issue? So man, they do some what I call theological alchemy, where they just start throwing whatever they can to the pot, and hopefully they walk out with some sort of gold or precious stone. And that's what they think they accomplish. But what they have to do is they'll have multiple resurrections. They even suggest that the people that are deceived are only the people that are born after the year 901, because no one in the millennium can live past 100 years if they're not belonging to Jesus. I mean, you just get the weirdest development of this simple picture. So that doesn't really help me with much answers. It actually caused me more problems. So let's take it from the amillennial perspective. Amillennials come along and they say, the 1,000 years is defined from the first coming of Christ to the second coming of Christ. It's a figurative number that stretches throughout the whole church age. Okay. And then you talk to G.K. Beale about, in his commentary, of what the release of Satan's all about. He says, oh, the release of Satan means that right before Jesus comes back, it's going to get really bad. As a matter of fact, in an email, he said this, it articulated in this exact form. He said, right before Jesus comes back, the church will almost be extinguished. And then he'll come back and save us. And that's what the release of Satan's all about. But my question back to him is, what do I do with the first half of verse 7? When the 1,000 years are over? Because if from an amillennial perspective, you are defining the 1,000 years as the time period between the first coming and the second coming of Christ, when the 1,000 years are over, what should that be? The second coming. Therefore, the release of Satan, according to your definitions, would have to occur after Jesus came back, not right before. You see the problem? So what does this text do? In our churches, in all of our people, our theologies, it's confusing. No one knows what to do with it. And this is how I think Empire Studies can help. Let's look at a couple of details. Verses 1 through 3. And I saw an angel coming down out of heaven, having the key to the abyss, and holding in his hand a great chain. He seized the dragon, that ancient serpent, who is the devil or Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. So what happens? Satan is bound, right? The exact word that he's using here is halusis, which is actually pointing in manacles. Chains. He's chained. Like manacles, fetters. You guys know what I'm talking about? Okay. He's bound, number one. Verse 3, he threw him into the abyss and locked and sealed it over him to keep him from deceiving the nations anymore until 1,000 years are ended. What just happened there? He's put into prison. Two, right? So what two things happened to Satan in the first three verses? He's bound with the chain, manacled. Two, put into a prison. Okay? Then, it says, after a short time, or he must be set free for a short time. After the 1,000 years, he must be set free for a short time. The word must there is the Greek word day, which in this context would be called the divine necessity. He must, by God's will, he must be set free. And if you're reading this for the first time in the Asia Minor, you're going, why must Satan be set free? Why does God set him free? I'm not understanding this. It's actually compounded further. Well, we'll get there in verse 7. When the 1,000 years are over, Satan will be released from his prison and will go out to deceive the nations in the four corners. What did you notice there? Or did you notice anything? What happens to him in verses 1 through 3? He's bound and imprisoned. What's he released from in verse 7? The prison. What is he not released from? His chains. And he will go out to deceive the nations, and he gathers them together for the battle of Gog and Magog to gather them for battle. In number, they are like the sand of the seashore. They march across the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of God's people, the city he loves. But fire came down from heaven and devoured them. Why does Satan must be? Why must he be released? Okay, here is how empire studies helps. Remember our discussion of Roman triumphal processions, where the key point was whenever you did the arm, whenever you destroyed the enemy nation, you would then have a couple of days, even Pompey in the first century BC, 3 days. And even after it was over, there's still more spoils could have been paraded through the streets, showing what had been dominated. And whenever you're going through the streets, they also have placards that are all the names of the different places that were conquered. They even have little models of the cities they destroyed. And they have all the different weapons and shields and swords and all these different things on display for all the people that weren't in the battle to experience with them. And it's this great moment of humiliation for the soldiers who are also paraded throughout the streets. As a matter of fact, what they would do is they would even at times, a way of executing the soldiers, they would stop, have the soldiers reenact one part of the battle they just lost, and in that execute each other. And then they'd keep marching. But the key point of the triumph procession was the last two elements. You would have the key enemy leader, the chief enemy leader, bound in chains, walking in front of the general. And the general comes in his quadriga with his chariot, and he is the climax of the triumphal procession. And what's interesting is we have triumphal imagery in Revelation 19, 11 through 21, where Jesus comes in riding on a white horse and everybody is surrounding him dressed in white, and you have a reenactment of a battle. For the false prophet and the beast, they gather for war, but there never is one. It's an execution. And people will say, oh, well, matter of fact, David Allen even says, it kind of seems like Jesus is a triumphal procession, but he's only on a single white horse, and normally they have a chariot. This is interesting. In 71, when Vespasian and Titus, when they were coming back from destroying the Jews in AD 70, and they were having the people enact the war, Vespasian and Titus were the ones that fought the battle, so they were in the quadriga, they were in the big chariot. But riding next to the chariot was Domitian on a single white horse. Because he wasn't directly involved. He was a part of the battle. He gets the victory of the battle, but he himself was not the general. Domitian, by the way, was the emperor in which Revelation was written. So Jesus, in Revelation 19, is on the white horse. But what it tells you is that he's not the general of the story here. We're still missing two elements. We're missing the key enemy leader, and we're missing the general. My argument is this. The reason why Satan must be released is to take part in God's triumphal procession. Because what he does is he gathers all the enemies and they reenact a war that Jesus already won on the cross. But it's not actually them gathering for battle, it's them marching to an execution. And that is the climax of every Roman triumph. Whenever the chief enemy leader was wiped out and the people spread with jubilation, the climax of humiliation and the climax of celebration with victory. And then what do we see in Revelation 21? Who emerges? The one on the throne. The throne, very first time it was mentioned, was in Revelation chapter 4, paralleling Ezekiel 1 through chapter 3. And in Ezekiel 1 through 3, the throne looks kind of like a chariot, doesn't it? And the one like the throne, one on the throne comes from heaven, descending as the climax of the triumphal procession. Why must Satan be released? So that God's triumphal procession can happen. And all of a sudden, what theology messes up and what Old Testament doesn't give us help with, if you bring in empire studies, it paints a beautiful picture of Christians in Asia Minor being persecuted. But what he says is, the key tool that's being used for Rome to subject you and to let you know the dominance that you have over you is now flipped on its head, and it's actually what's being shown to be your liberation. Now, let me show you where some textual intersection comes here. At the apex, in the city of Ephesus, the first city mentioned in Revelation chapter 2, at the apex, there was a temple dedicated in honor of the worship of Domitian as a god, the emperor at the time Revelation was written. The emperor that was riding on the single white horse next to his dad and brother. Right outside of this temple, there is an altar. And every day, the altar would be offering sacrifices in worship of Domitian. And these sacrifices rise up. But if you look at the sides and in the front, I should have my picture up. I don't have it with me. I'll describe it to you. On the far left side, there is a bull that's being prepared for sacrifice. And over the top of him is laurel decor, laurel wreaths, which is the symbol of the Roman triumph. On the other side, you have two shields and you have two swords. And on the front, you have all kinds of spoils of war, from shields and swords and all kinds of things. And right in the center of the front panel, you have an enemy, single-bound enemy, bowing down with his hands manacled behind his back. And you have a Roman person holding up an object about ready to execute him. And every single day, the Christians would be walking down the street of Ephesus. They would look at the Roman triumph that symbolized Rome's dominance over them. And John says, let me take that image, turn it on its head, and this is God's triumphal procession. And I'm telling you right now, stuff like that'll preach. Stuff like that'll preach. So it doesn't just say God wins. It says even when the world says we win and they depict it in our faces, God turns it on his head and says, actually, that's showing that I win. And Satan's release is not something to be worried about, not something to be confused about. It's something to be celebrated. And I find that beautiful. Is it time? Okay, what I want to do next time, darn it, Drew, I wanted to get to you. We're going to start next time reflecting a little bit on empire studies in your own passages or other things you've noticed. And then we're going to do some of the extra credit pictures. And then we'll start on the history of Rome so we can start developing the sovereign narrative. Love you guys. See you next Tuesday.